How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome to Blogging Theology. Today we're pleased to speak to Brother Dr. Safaruk Chowdhury. How are you, Khisaf? It's good to have you back on Blogging Theology.
Assalamu alaikum, Basah. How are you, Khis? Great to be with you.
Alhamdulillah. Saf studied philosophy at King's College London, completing it with accompanying Associate of King's College Award. He then traveled to Cairo, studying the traditional Islamic studies curricula at Al-Azhar University. He returned to the UK to complete his MA at the School of Oriental and African Studies with distinction. His doctoral dissertation was on the eminent Sufi hagiographer and theoretician Abdul Rahman al-Sulami, published as a Sufi apologist of Nishapur, The Life and Thought of Abu Abdul Rahman al-Sulami, published by Equinox Publishing in 2019. Saf's research interests, in addition to Sufism at the moment, are in paraconsistent logic, metaphysics, ethics, and epistemology, with a keen interest in how these subjects were articulated and discussed within the Islamic intellectual tradition, especially within Kalam theology. His most recent book is entitled Islamic Theology and the Problem of Evil, published by AUC Press in 2021, which is the first work in Islamic studies to treat the topic within the analytic theology approach. Saf completed a role as lead researcher on an innovative project entitled Beyond Foundationalism, New Horizons in Muslim Analytic Theology. Apologies because my screen turned off. A Muslim Analytic Theology funded under a John Templeton Foundation grant award in association with Cambridge Muslim College and Aziz Foundation. He is writing a monograph on Islamic epistemology and the virtue epistemology tradition. Saf runs the IslamicAnalyticTheology.org website, and his academic work can be found on his academia page, safchowdhury.academia.edu. And I'll place the links in the description box below. Today, we're going to be learning about different things, inshallah. So many of us may have heard of terms such as Platonism and nominalism. Well, what do these terms mean? And why is it relevant for us to know? Are there any serious theological implications for Islamic beliefs if we were to adopt Platonism or nominalism? Is there room for embracing the validity of both of these views, or only one of them, or neither? Inshallah, Brother Saf will be shedding light on some of these questions and much more. And without further ado, Brother Saf, the floor is all yours.
Thank you, Bassam. Always great to be here with you on the platform. Great work that everyone's doing here. May Allah accept the effort. Of course, you know, never to forget, we're having this session at the time now when, you know, Iranian bombs on Rafah. May Allah Azza wa Jalla relieve our brothers and sisters there in Gaza and everywhere where the Mustada'afeen, Madhlumeen, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, we ask Allah Azza wa Jalla to make the affairs easy and to grant the victory. Ameen, Ya Rabbana Alameen.
Ameen.
Sort of on our topic today, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahmanirrahim, wassalatu wassalamu ala Rasulillah wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa man wala. Well, Ba'd, I just want to make sure that the screen, everyone can see the screen.
Yes, we can.
Brilliant. So as the topic states here, we're going to look at something called realism, anti-realism, and then link it to Islamic theology. So nothing grand or, you know, novel in the title, or innovative in the title. But hopefully, as we go along, the session, you know, will become clear as to what is emerging and what is the discussion that is taking place or is being constructed around these topics. Much of what, if folks want to read, can be found in a sort of handout I've got on my academia page. And it's,
we can link to it, inshallah.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for that. That's fine. And that's nearly about, you know, quite a hefty handout for those who want to do much of the reading from this session. What I want to do today here is set up the discussion from the pre-modern context and then look at a contemporary context of this subject matter of realism, anti-realism within Islamic theology. So let me just tell you what we're going to do. That picture there, by the way, is just AI-assisted two people talking about something called Nafs al-Amr, but I'll come to that topic a bit later. Okay, so let's look at some terms, but before I do that, let me do the outline of the session where I hope to begin and I hope to end, bi-idhnillahi ta'ala. So I'm gonna start with some terms like Platonism, mathematical Platonism. Then I'm gonna move on to something called abstract objects, and it links to mathematical Platonism, as we're gonna see. Then I'm going to cover why is this entity called abstract entities? Why are they invoked? Why do philosophers believe in them? And then why would some Muslims want to believe in them, whatever they are? But I'll come to explain them. Then in theology, we've got something which in contemporary analytic philosophy of religion, we've got something called the problem of God and abstract objects. And then I'm going to look at how that general problem has an Islamic iteration or an Islamic version, you could say. Then we want to look at where do we locate these abstract objects, whatever they are. Then I'm going to look at some Muslim realist views and anti-realist views. Then a contemporary discussion, which is carried on from medieval discussions. And this is the issue of Nafs al-Amr. And then I'll conclude with some of my own thoughts. So that's the kind of 11-point sketch of the session, inshallah, today. Brilliant. So let's start then with our terms. So we've got Platonism. And this is, I'm referring to Platonism here as, in broad strokes, and again, I know those who are specialists in this area, will know that I'm passing out a lot, I'm missing out on a lot of nuance and detail, which is inevitable in an introduction. So Platonism, as I'm going to be sort of generally using it here, is the philosophical system articulated by Plato that is defined by one of the defining features of this philosophical system, if not its linchpin, is defined by eternal and unchanging realities, known as the ethos or ideia, the ideas, the forms. And these forms are the cause of all existence in the cosmos, in the universe, as well as the thing that grounds or is the origin or basis of all value and meaning. And these forms, these ethos or ideia, they are ideal abstract entities, they're not physical things. So that's Platonism. Then we've got something called mathematical Platonism. Now this, in the philosophy of mathematics or in analytic philosophy in general, that is, mathematical Platonism is the view that mathematical entities or mathematicalia, like numbers, sets, whatever they may be, yeah, these things are they have three qualities. They're real, but they have three qualities. They are abstract. They're not concrete. They're not physical. They have existence, and they're independent of what anyone thinks or knows or believes. And mathematical Platonism, you could say, is the view that abstract objects I'm about to define now, abstract objects they're real, they are independent of any mind. So that's mathematical Platonism. So I'm going to be using mathematical Platonism and the view that abstract objects exist sort of interchangeably. So if you believe that abstract objects exist, objects that are abstract, real, independent of anyone's mind, then you would be a mathematical Platonist.
So is mathematical Platonism exactly like Platonism, but you're just dealing with numbers only? Or is there...
Yeah, but again, the reason why I don't want to equate the two together is because not all philosophers and scientists and mathematicians who hold to the reality of numbers are necessarily Platonists in the sense of Plato. They adhere or subscribe to Plato's philosophy.
Okay.
This is the reason why I don't want to equate the two together. Okay. It's just the reason why it's called mathematical Platonism is Platonism is another term for being realist. You hold them to be real. So you could call you could replace Platonism, if it's confusing, with mathematical realism. And in fact, realism, anti-realism are the terms that I'm going to be using simply because a lot of people just don't like the term Platonism because of the baggage that it has. Okay, so we've got those two terms. We've got a third term, and this is known as nominalism. Nominalism in metaphysics, for those who are studying philosophy, is the idea that, the view that universals, i.e. something that can extend to many things, like redness, is a universal, because lots of objects can exemplify or hold or possess the property of redness. So red being a color is a universal, and abstract objects, objects that I'm about to describe in a bit more detail, they are not real. So nominalists deny the existence of universals and or abstract objects. Rather, nominalists assert that only particulars exist, things, and only concrete things exist. And so whenever we refer to purportedly abstract objects or universals like color, you know, things like that, we are actually just giving names or just labeling common features that objects have. There is no real.
Save big money at Menards. Never get locked out from lost keys again. Menards carries a huge selection of electronic lock sets. Get a TrueBolt touchscreen deadbolt that features one-touch locking and 50 programmable user codes. Available in matte black or satin nickel finishes, on sale now through September 8th at Menards. America's number one home improvement retailer for customer satisfaction, according to J.D. Power. Visit jdpower.com for details and menards.com for deals.
Save big money.
Reality behind them. So nominalism also can go by the name of anti-realism. So you've got Platonism and nominalism, and then you've got realism, anti-realism. I'm just going to be using them interchangeably. Yeah.
But, you know, I can imagine some of our listeners thinking to themselves, you know, I mean, how is it that a Platonist would actually believe in a, you know, in the universal red, right?
Yeah.
Is there some actual redness floating in the air somewhere, or some redness, you know, that is spaceless and timeless, yeah, actually exists, you know, extra mentally outside of our mind? Is that how far Platonism goes?
Yes. And I'm gonna And I'm gonna explain some of the motivations behind it, mm-hmm, in just a moment. Yes, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. They are real entities. Okay. Yeah.
And this would apply. Right. This would apply, yep, to everything, right? So that would apply to water. It would apply to glass. It would apply to anything that we can,
yeah,
think
property
of. There, yeah, is a, there's a universal property out there, you know, representing it somehow, right?
Yeah, definitely. Properties are abstract objects, so they will exist. Properties will exist independently of the objects that exemplify the property. Yes. Okay. Yes. And like, it, you know, whereas Plato sort of held it in the realm of forms, you know, this sort of absolute, unchanging, eternal realm, right? You know, Platonists or realists would say they exist. Now, where they exist, we'll come to that, because it's a matter of now locating them. Where are you going to locate them if you believe in them? But we'll come to that definitely in a few slides, inshallah. So those are some three key terms I thought I'd get out of the way. And then we're going to come on to sort of our main term now, which is abstract objects. So abstract objects in contemporary analytic philosophy, or philosophy of mathematics, is the view that there are entities, types of objects like numbers, like properties, sets, possible worlds, universals, things like that, that are uncreated. They're non-physical, they're not a thing, they're non-spatial, they're not extended in space, they're immutable, no one can change them, they're outside of our sensory experience, they're causally inert, they don't impose or affect change in something, they're not agents in that respect, and they can be closed off to us accessing them with our minds. They're beyond and above our minds. So abstract objects then have this kind of nature, and they are contrasted with philosophers contrast them with, concrete objects. Concrete objects are like, you know, you, I, you know, human beings, books, mobile phones, cars, whatever it might be, trees, plants, and things that are created. They're physical, they're spatial, they're temporal, they are sensible, i.e. they're within they can fall within the senses, they are changeable, and they exert causal influence. So that's sort of the difference between an abstract object and concrete objects. So if there are such objects, as we're going to see why many philosophers want to believe that there are, we're going to see a slide later. I'll set up the problem theologically now. So we need to know that if abstract objects are like this, they are going to create a problem. But let's see why there might be a reason why philosophers want to posit such objects, right? And this is the next slide. I'll mention very briefly why, you know, there are robust reasons for believing in abstract objects, i.e. to adopt a Platonist perspective. And let's go through some of them then. On this slide, does that sort of seem clear, Sam? So obviously uncreated, they're not physical.
Yeah.
They're not,
The only thing I was thinking about, but I didn't want to digress from the subject, sure. Would some philosophers say that, okay, you could have a concrete object, but it doesn't necessarily have all of these characteristics?
A concrete object or an abstract object?
A concrete object. Mainly a concrete
maybe
object.
Because
I mean, you'd have philosophers describing God as concrete, but not affirming that he's physical or spatial.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. For example, is it an immaterial concrete object? Absolutely.
So basically, I didn't want to digress too much, but you know.
You're right.
If you're contrasting it with abstract and that it exists actually in reality and you can actually see it, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's physical. So maybe it's one of these features. It has at least one of these. But the main point you're driving here, though. But
The reason why I set it up in this way, so abstract objects is quite notorious to define the metaphysics literature. So a lot of people just sort of contrast it with concrete, just so we get an idea. But you're right in terms of God being a concrete object, and I obviously in Islamic theology early on, the word shape, referring to Allah Azza wa Jal, you know, there is some, whether that falls within, whether it's proper to use that term, even though rationally it may not be, it wouldn't be incorrect to use the term, but because of the connotations of shaykh, theologians said they don't use the word. So if that is the case, then that would put in contemporary terms, Allah as being a concrete object, can see, plus Allah being able to be seen, to be heard, Jalla wa Ala. So that would mean that he's not an abstract entity in that sense. Yeah. So he will be a concrete, if we want to adopt that nomenclature. Yeah, but you're right. Yeah, you're right to mention that nuance. Does a concrete object necessarily have to be exhaustively? Does it exhaust the list of qualities that are on there in the table? Okay, cool. So why then believe in such objects? What would be the motivations for believing in them? Now, I've got six here. Again, philosophers will differ over these. So you've got, for example, one reason why philosophers and theologians want to believe in abstract objects is this idea that abstract objects help us explain predication. So this sort of Platonist framework, this framework that abstract objects are real, helps us to understand when we say an object has a predicate, a quality or a property. For example, if you say the apple is red and I say this sweet is red and somebody says this ball is red, on this sort of realist Platonist view that abstract objects are real, redness is an abstract object but has different instances of it, of the redness. So in one instance, one is the redness of the sweet. The other instance is the redness of the apple. In the apple, you know, is an instance of that redness. And then the ball is another instance of that redness. So we can explain how different objects have the same property or quality by saying that there is a there is a quality of an abstract nature that all three possess or instantiate or exemplify. So that helps us understand predication, truth and objectivity. So you've got here those who believe in abstract objects are realists or Platonists. They would support the idea that truths of mathematics, truths of logic are objective and independent of human thought, right? And so 2 + 2 = 4, regardless of what you may think and I may think, the law of identity, the law of non-contradiction, the law of the excluded middle, these are true regardless of what anyone thinks. And so it's crucial for coherence and reliability of logic, of mathematics, that the truth can't be subject to individual and cultural variations. We must be able to anchor objectivity. And the best way to anchor it is through saying that there is an objective reality that is abstract and beyond any instantiation or cultural variance or individual subjective variance. So in order to preserve truth and objectivity, we need them to be at a higher plane. Other reasons are like mathematical practice. A realist or Platonist account, on a Platonist or realist account, mathematical entities exist independent of, however they relate to other things in the world, and mathematics capturing the structure and reality of the world and things can only be possible if they were abstract and beyond sort of subjective considerations. So it's a bit like number two. We can't do faithfully and accurately and properly unless mathematics by its nature in describing and predicting phenomena and in the physical world, unless they were abstract, invariant, unchanging, things like that. Semantic considerations. Here, Platonists say, when we talk about whether it's mathematical language or things in the abstract, when we talk about the like numbers, sets, functions, these must be things that are real that we're referring to. They are not empty references. There's an object behind our referencing these things. So by you referring to, let's say, sets, and me referring to sets, and you referring to numbers, and me referring to numbers, we're both referring to the same reality above and beyond you and me. And so these concepts or ideas or realities allow us to talk in a meaningful, coherent, intelligible way. The other argument is what they call the ontological commitment argument, and that is that, look, whatever our best explanations of the world require us to believe, we should believe them. So our best theories about the world, whether that's mathematical theories, scientific theories, whatever theories we have about the world, whatever they require us to believe, we should believe them. And our best theories about the world, our best scientific and mathematical theories about the world, require us to force us to be committed to the existence of numbers, of sets, of propositions, of these entities. And so if we don't believe in them, then we cannot do mathematics and science that we'd like to do. This is called the indispensability argument. These things are indispensable for our theories, so we need them. So by implying that we need them, we are then committed to their ontology, to them existing. And number six, this is what some philosophers believe. I'm not saying all philosophers who are realists or Platonists believe this, is that, it's intuitive to believe in objects or realities behind the realities that we're referring to. It's very intuitive. It seems natural that when we refer to things, we believe that there are objects behind those references. So when I talk about numbers, I'm just assuming when I'm referring to the number two, you're referring to the number two. Implicitly, we're just intuitively accepting that there is a two. There is numbers exist. So we would need some strong convincing to move us away from our intuition. So these are sort of in a rough way, some of the reasons why, there are more, some of the reasons why many philosophers commit to the existence of abstract objects. These are some philosophical reasons. So if now we accept abstract objects exist, if we are mathematical Platonists, or if we are Platonists or realists, but at the same time we are Muslim or we're theists, for example, what now? And now we're going to move on to the issue of the problem of God and abstract objects. So if there are such objects that are abstract and they are of this nature, uncreated, non-physical, non-spatial, etc., etc., as a believer, what do we do now with these objects?
Okay, I think now some listeners are saying to themselves, that's why Bassam and Saf are talking about this today.
I wanted to get onto that. This is not a philosophy session, of course.
Yeah. I can imagine, like, why are they dedicating time to this topic? Okay, so
but I wanted to build the philosophical background. Absolutely. Before I move on, let me give you some theological, Islamic theological reasons why someone might commit to abstract objects existing. And here's two reasons. So I've called it the Islamic iteration for, you know, the need for abstract objects.
So these are arguments that some Muslim Platonists would provide.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm not saying in any way these are just to be pushed aside. I'm saying here are two.
Something
and
to contend with. Yeah.
And I think maybe our community can pick up these arguments. I'm not saying they're very good. I've formulated them. I haven't seen others formulate it in contemporary time. So there's lots to think about, lots to accept, lots to reject. So let's take Quranic concepts, ideas mentioned in the Quran, like qist, wa aqimul wazna bil, right? La'adil. So it's a qist, fairness, la'adil, justice, the concept of ma'roof, good, the good, for lack of a better word, you know, in English, you know, we can pass these out in better translation. I'm just using one word, sort of substitutes. Haq, which could be truth, reality. Ahkam, plural of divine judgments, or it could be a judgment from a human being, like hukum hissi, hukum aqli, and so on. So what are the nature of these things? What are the nature of these things? Surely, a realist might argue, these are sort of objectively existing things. They're not just mere labels, surely. They're not just words Allah Azza wa Jalla is just saying us to use without any referent behind them, right? I.e., there is no qist, objective qist. There is no adl, that's objective. There is no ma'roof, that's objective, etc., etc. So surely these terms must be above and beyond human predilection, human hawa, human whims, human desires, human caprices. So these terms must refer to real abstract entities that exist independently of what you and I think, what a believer or a non-believer thinks. Because if they were merely subjective, if they were merely subjectively defined terms or subjectively constructive terms, then they would lack authority, universality, and things like that. So that's maybe one religious theological motivation. The second motivation is what I'm calling the indispensability argument. So Quranic i'jaz. So here's how the indispensability argument, one structure of the argument may look like. You've got premise one, whatever is absolutely necessary for our most cogent account of i'jaz would require that we believe in it. So if our most cogent, strongest account of i'jaz requires us to believe in this thing, then we should believe it. We are committed to it. Abstract objects are indispensable for our most cogent account of i'jaz. Therefore, we are committed to, or we are required to believe in, you know, abstract objects are sort of required for our best and most cogent theories of i'jaz. So we are required to believe.
Basically, there must be a real form of i'jaz out there in order for us to claim that the Quran is truly a miracle. So if the concept of i'jaz doesn't literally truly exist out there, and you can't make up or concoct a standard in your own mind and say, oh, this is i'jaz. If we want to steel man the argument, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So premise one is like, you could call it the sort of theoretical indispensability premise, where if a concept is essential for explaining a phenomenon comprehensively, then we ought to, epistemically, we ought to embrace, or we are committed to, rather, to that those entities that require that our theories require. So,
yeah, that's not controversial. That's not controversial.
Yeah, that's not controversial, right? I think so. Okay. So premise two, abstract objects are indispensable for our most cogent account of e'tijaz. So this is where some dispute might arise. For example, premise two would yani require saying things like the Quranic i'tijaz conforms to or corresponds to like an archetypal nazm, like a structure or form. Now, structure and form are not concrete things, right? What are they by nature? They are non-concrete, or if we're using the words we're using today, they're abstract. So patterns, form, structure, these are not reducible to mere, the realist would argue, the Muslim realist would argue, these are not reducible to mere physical or mental constructs. So the i'tijaz of the Quran is in virtue of some non-physical transcendent structure or form, beyond the mere instantiations of the lexical items, like the words, the huruf, the kalimat. So it looks like from this indispensability argument, for our most cogent account of i'tijaz, which is nazm al-Qur'an, the nazm of the Qur'an, it seems to require us to believe in a configuration of features to give us a structure that is not physical. So that, you know, that is one type of argument. Yeah. So now somebody might dispute. They might want to dispute number one. Okay. But let's say you know, the different parties agree on number one because it's a reasonable premise. But number two would be definitely the challengeable premise. Do we need for our theory of i'tijaz or our model of i'tijaz? Do we need abstract objects? Can the inimitability, the i'tijaz, be explained through a historical argument, perhaps? Or tawatur, for example. Tawatur is not the fact that you can establish temporal contiguity between the Quran that we have now and the Quran that was revealed at the time of Nabi alayhi afdalu salatu wa atamu taslim. We have a temporal contiguity. Right, there's no break. Quran then we have is a Quran we have now. Or somebody might say, we can show a confidence argument where up until now the Quranic challenge has not been met by anyone. There's no recorded instance of anyone claiming they have met the challenge and the challenge being met being accepted. And therefore, everyone declaring the Quranic i'tijaz to be false, or there's been mu'aradha of the Quran. There's been a rival or a counter to the Quran. None whatsoever have been recorded. So based on that, we can have epistemic confidence that the Quran is miraculous, etc., etc., etc. So some people could argue it's not a necessary premise, like you know, premise number two.
You know, I guess at this point, I'm still struggling to understand, you know, the Platonist's conception of realism here. You know, if he is not going to ascribe concrete properties to these concepts like qist and adl and ma'ruf and assert that, you know, they cannot be seen, they cannot be heard, they cannot be tasted. You know, and all those other properties of abstract objects that you mentioned prior, then in what sense does he deem them to really exist, right? Like, what would be the difference between a nominalist and a Platonist if both the nominalist and the Platonist agree that these are the properties of abstract objects, unless the Platonist ascribes concrete properties to abstract objects. But it wasn't my understanding that they do that. They do not. So yeah, so I guess if you ask the nominalist and the Platonist, what's the difference between both of your stances if you both ascribe the same properties to abstract objects? It's just that one is going to say, well, I think they literally exist. And the other will say, I don't think they literally exist. But it seems quite vacuous unless there's a difference in ascription of properties to abstract objects. I still don't, like, I really don't understand the conception of realism in the mind of the Platonist here.
Well, the nominalist wants to say that there are no such things, abstract objects. So the nominalist rejects abstract objects because of their abstract nature. That's the point. And they reject universal
Because of their properties. Because of its properties.
Because of that nature, Whereas the Platonist, as I said, the reason why they want to invoke such entities is for the motivations I mentioned before. Now, for the Muslim who subscribes to that particular view, they want to say these can't just be empty labels, right? They can't just be things that refer to nothing.
Yeah, but I guess my struggle here is if I were to keep pushing the Platonist, I mean, all that is understandable, right? Their motivations for adopting their view, I think you clearly explained it in the, you know, in this slide and the previous one. But I guess I'm just trying to understand what they mean when they say abstract objects really exist. Because if they're going to affirm that they are uncreated, non-physical, non-spatial, immutable, outside of sensory experience, causally inert, epistemically inaccessible, then in what sense do they truly exist if they have all these properties? I guess the nominalist, for myself, I would ask, wait a minute, how can something really exist, truly exist, if it has all these properties, right? And that's where I'm confused, right? I'm just trying to understand what they mean. What's their conception of realism here? What, you know, the nominalist and the Platonist both agree that these are the properties of abstract objects.
Yeah.
So then in what sense then can the Platonist go on to say, but they really truly exist, but on what basis? What's your ground? On what basis are you saying that they truly exist if they have all these properties? I guess that would be my question to them.
You're saying that in effect it becomes a
I would argue, I don't know, it could be the theological school that I ascribe to, I don't know, but I think an object that has all these properties just doesn't exist in reality. I guess that's where I would like to hear a Platonist articulate his conception of true existence for an object that has these features, because I just can't fathom an object with all these characteristics literally existing, you know, or as we would say, you know, qa'im bi nafsi, right? So I don't know.
Well, these would have to be qa'im bi nafsi. So we're gonna have to that might neatly bring us into the theology where these objects, if they exist, so given the sort of picture that we've got, that there are such things, let's say there are such things as these abstract objects, and there are philosophical reasons and motivations to believe them, and then there are theological reasons. So Muslims here specifically, so there are some theological reasons to believe them, mm-hmm. or commit to believing them. What does that do for someone who believes in God now? So in the philosophical literature, this is the problem of God and Platonism. Or
just out of curiosity, Asaf, who would you say in our Islamic tradition adopted Platonism? I mean, would it be the Falasifa or some of them or not all of them?
Definitely. And in some areas of metaphysics, you know, some later Mutakallimun did. You see it in the later post-classical tradition. So after Imam Fakhruddin al-Razi, rahimahullah, so after him, where you got sort of philosophized kalam, or you've got kalam with a blend of higher metaphysics, Avicennanized, or whichever label you want to use it. We know that within the Islamic tradition, within the lungs of the Islamic tradition, Avicenna, you know, it was breathed into the lungs of the tradition after him. So, many, you know.
And would you say that anyone from the Ash'ari or Maturidi Mutakallimun got impacted by this?
Yeah, definitely in some, you know, later, you know, in specific aspects when I come to the issue of Nafs al-Amr.
Okay.
We'll look at that. So we've got the Akbari tradition as well, and that have a commitment to this sort of higher realism or sort of thick or heavyweight realism, because the discussion, as we're going to see a bit later as well, is also linked to without these objects, without an objective reality, can you have intelligibility? Not only grounding, metaphysical grounding, can you have intelligibility? Can you make sense of your experience without this realm of objective, metaphysical, abstract entities? What was I going to
say? Right now, we're on the theological problem with
that. Yeah. So let me set it up philosophically in terms of how it is, in you'll find it in the literature in a basic way, and then we'll go to the Islamic iteration of it. So I think, you know, Gould did a nice summary of the problem philosophically. And so I'm just going to quote the reference here, and let's look at it. So he says here, quote, as a being worthy of worship, a God, a necessary being, is typically thought to exist a se. So Paul Gould is saying, as a being worthy of worship, God, a necessary being, is typically thought to exist a se. That is, God is an independent and self-sufficient being. Further, God is typically thought to be supremely sovereign over all distinct reality in this sense. All reality distinct from God is dependent on God's creative and sustaining activity. Thus, a traditional theist will endorse the following aseity sovereignty doctrine, what he calls AD. AD means, one, God does not depend on anything distinct from himself for his existing. And two, everything distinct from God depends on God's creative activity for its existing. But the view that there are abstract objects that also exist necessarily seems to be a repudiation of the aseity sovereignty doctrine. The reason is this: it is natural to think that if something exists necessarily, it does so because it is its nature to exist. Thus, abstract objects exist independently of God, which is therefore a repudiation of AD and traditional theism. In other words, if we are going to be committed to entities of the kind that we've been describing, uncreated, abstract, invariant, timeless, spaceless, etc., etc., then what we're in effect saying is, with God, there are these other entities, because you're saying they're real, right? They're not just a figment of your imagination. They're actually really existing things. Well, if they do exist, then we've got a problem if you believe in the traditional view of God. Now,
are there any realist atheists?
Yeah, there are.
Okay.
They have a count of abstract objects that would be in the reality, the physical, natural world.
So I guess this objection may not bother them then, but
maybe not.
I guess they're a rarity.
But if you're an atheist and you believe in your Platonist, you still have to give an account for your Platonism, right? Philosophically, independently of theology, it's not just a given, right? Okay, so what would be the Islamic iteration, as I'm putting it, for the problem of abstract objects and God? There's this idea you reference, al-qa'im bi nafsi, Allah is self-subsisting, so he's hayyun qayyum, so his qayyumiyya is part of his nature, he's self-subsistent. If a Muslim believes in these abstract objects, would that compromise this idea of Allah being hayyun qayyum? And what about Allah's sovereignty, having unrestricted sovereignty and power? Doesn't that encroach on Allah's, his mulukiyya, his sovereign reign of all of creation, as well as his power? Because then these will be objects beyond his power, right? They already exist and not within his creative power. You have Allah's ultimacy being undermined. He would not just be the ultimate being. There'll be other beings beside him, these abstract entities. Then there's the problem of location. Where are you going to put these AOs if you believe them as a Muslim? Outside of Allah, inside of Allah, you know, where are you going to put them? And we'll look at the typology of that in just a moment. There is the problem of what I'm calling inflationary ontology. Are we believing too many things beyond the ordinary? You know, are we committed to, a kind of ontological obesity? Is it overweight ontology? Yeah. And what about the doctrine of, you know, Allah creating everything, lam in shay, not from anything, or adam is shay? This creatio ex nihilo, surely, you know, most Muslims want to believe that there was nothing and then Allah created everything. But if abstract objects exist and are eternal and uncreated, then there will be things already existing before Allah even created the universe ex nihilo. So unless someone wants to believe in, you know, creatio ex aliqua, right? You know, you create from existing matter, right? You have some stuff from which you make something already, like Plato's Demiurgos. The Demiurgos creates from pre-existing matter according to some predetermined form.
I mean, if I could push back on that point, if I were to, you know, play the Platonist here, I'll just argue, okay, sure, so the forms and the universals are eternal, but that does not necessitate that God, that I affirm that God must create out of pre-existing material. I believe that God could create, I don't know, a blue sky out of nothing, even though the color blue is already existing as a form. It's just that the blue is there as some kind of reference point for us to then utilize it so that we can identify that the heavens or that the sky that Allah created is blue.
Yeah.
But it may not be the case that God had to take some matter out of the form and then create out of it, the heavens, right? I don't necessarily see the connection between affirming the Platonic forms and mode of Allah's creating.
The question then is where do you want to locate the blueprint that the divine is using to create creation? If it's external to him, then his self-subsistence, his sovereignty,
absolutely.
You know, there's gonna
That's absolutely problematic. So that means Allah would not be free to declare that this is what I deem to be a blue sky without him violating, either he would have to utter an untruth, وَلْعِيَادُ بِاللَّهِ, because in reality we know that blue is whatever the form says it is, or he would have to subject himself, وَلْعِيَادُ بِاللَّهِ, once again, to that pre-eternal form of blue, right? So there's definitely a problem there. I'm with you on that. But also, I guess I was talking more about the mode of creation. I don't know. I don't see the connection, but but Allah's sovereignty and is definitely compromised here. That's pretty
because, cool. As we're going to see, this spills into all other areas. It spills into ethics. Is an objective reality of abstract, and it goes of abstract entities that are, is truth, goodness, and beauty beyond God, or is it? And so you fall into the whole sort of, are there objective ethical truths beyond or ethical realm beyond the divine, or is ethics grounded in the divine commands, etc., etc.? So it has a spillage on so many different areas of theology. The two in bold that I wanted to put there is, so the Islamic iteration of the problem of abstract objects, is there some kind of scriptural basis for raising this worry? And then you've got, a hadith, which you could use. So there are lots of variations, as we know. كَانَ اللَّهُ وَلَمْ يَكُنْ شَيْءٌ غَيْرُ مَعَهُ قَبْلَهُ. And there are variations. The question, I guess, if we were to put a philosophical, some lens on this hadith of Sharif, is the shay here, وَلَمْ يَكُنْ شَيْءٌ غَيْرُ. What's the scope, if we could say? What's the scope of shay here in the hadith? The quantification appears to be quite unrestricted. That doesn't seem to imply a restrictive sense of the scope of negation. So if the negation is total, the scope of the quantification, if it's total, then that would be both concrete and abstract objects did not exist when Allah Azza wa Jal is, was, and so on. So could this, affirmation of abstract objects now go against the hadith? And we can bring some other sort of textual evidence, but I thought, that was something to think about because it explicitly mentions the word shape. So what do we take the scope to be? Yeah. Does it extend over?
I mean, I think very well, Saf, that, Ibn Taymiyyah might have a different spin on this hadith, right?
Yes.
Given that he affirmed that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala was always active, in the past. And I know Ibn Taymiyyah was a nominalist, but, it could be possible. I personally do not adopt his opinion. I don't think that, I know that there might be a couple of narrations out there that might, maybe from the Salaf, that might support Ibn Taymiyyah's, interpretation here, that it's possible that the scope here might be limited to our universe.
Yes.
But despite all of that, Ibn Taymiyyah would at the very least try to rightly or wrongly appeal to other scriptural texts to try to justify that specification, rightly or wrongly, right? I'm here still trying to wonder, you know, what scriptural texts Platonists would appeal to justify restricting the scope here, right? Because it seems to me that there's a lot of deduction going on here. Even though you gave that example of them appealing to ma'ruf and qist, still nothing there. It still seems like a more of a logical deduction rather than a scriptural text affirming something which supports their stance. And so, I mean, they might have some wiggle room here.
Yeah.
And I can imagine that they will wiggle out of it. But in the absence of any clear scriptural text, I wouldn't think that move is justified.
Well, you raised this really interesting point, because the matter then is this. How do we not settle the debate? I guess it's not about settling the debate, how we proceed with the debate. Is this a philosophical issue? Are there good philosophical reasons for adopting Platonism, for example, based on the six or so motivations that I mentioned earlier? Or even if there are good philosophical arguments, does that mean we are justified from scripture? So it now becomes, is it a discussion for scripture to be settled in, or outside of scripture and for us to settle it philosophically?
And I guess that goes back to the Platonist. We asked the Platonist, do you genuinely believe that your rational arguments are definitive, right? Like, yeah. Are these, you know, dilalat aqliya, qat'iya? Do you really believe that? Or do you just think that these are good arguments, but speculative, but which would probably still not justify restricting the scope of a clear scriptural text or nas?
Yeah.
So I think I would also go back to the Platonist to be genuine with himself. Like, you might think that these are good arguments, but you think they're definitively true? Because if he doesn't think they're definitively true, I think that would undermine the justification that he would then use to let rationality override the apparent reading of scripture.
Yeah, and then this is where one of the sites of the contestation is taking place, rather, as we'll see, is this a matter to be settled with philosophy, with more philosopher, or more revelation, more scripture? But just to sort of get through the slides a bit and going on to now, if you believe, okay, so once we've got this view, I mentioned the views at the beginning that there's Platonism, there's mathematical Platonism, there's nominalism. Then I went through terms of abstract objects, and then I went through the example of, you know, how the abstract objects, the motivations for believing in them, and how that has its Islamic iteration, and then the problem of God and abstract objects, and as we've just been discussing here right now, how the Islamic iteration plays out. Then we've got now, where are you going to locate abstract objects then, if you believe in them or you don't believe in them? And this little just sort of typology is just a sort of basic way to say, okay, we've set up the problem now, right? There seems to be these other entities alongside the divine. What kind of postures are there for Muslims? What views can Muslims adopt, or what's available to them that are quite common and out there when it comes to abstract objects? Okay, so we've got this idea that if we're going to start with the divine, then either abstract objects are external to Allah Azza wa Jal, which means some of it is going to be beyond his power, his will, because he didn't choose them to be there, right? He didn't create them. They were just there alongside him. That would be sort of heavyweight Platonism, what we've been talking about throughout. Or you can say abstract objects are internal to Allah in some way. And that internal thing could be you locate them in the divine knowledge or the divine thoughts or whatever it is, the ilm of Allah Azza wa Jal. And then so that would be a form of divine conceptualism. Or you say, no, it's not external to Allah. Sorry, it's not external to Allah beyond his control. It's not internal to Allah. Rather, abstract objects are real, but they've been created by Allah Azza wa Jal. And this is absolute creationism. So they're real. So abstract entities like properties, sets, numbers, possible worlds, everything else, yeah, that falls under the term abstract, beauty, justice, goodness, all of these are real. They are real. So you're realist in this sense, but their origin is from the creative activity of Allah Azza wa Jalla. Allah created them. So they're brought under his divine power.
Yeah. I'm curious to know whether those that would adopt absolute creationism would still argue whether the, you know, whether they are still necessary, right? So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, out of his nature, is necessarily creating them, or whether they're contingent, and you know, Allah could do without them and create us and create everything else without them.
Sure.
Or would they affirm that no, these would necessarily exist. However, we root them in Allah and they're not independent of Allah. But due to Allah's nature, out of his nature, he would have to create them. An interesting take.
Well, it would depend on then how the Muslim wants to pass out or explain the necessity they mean here.
Exactly.
Mm. You see. So they will come to it definitely. Then you've got those who say, no, let's locate abstract objects to not to a kind of absolute transcendental realm. Why move it? Why put it up there when we can move it down here into the reality? You can see. So abstract objects are immanently exist in each and every particular. Yeah. Each and every particular. And so this is the idea, the kind of Aristotelian, Avicennian, Farabian idea of moderate realism. Wherever you find an object that has that property, that is it. You know, it's in ray, it's in the object itself. It's not existing out there in some mind-independent realm. Then if you don't want to take that position, that it's in reality, not in the divine or up there in any way, then the other place you can locate it is within the mind. So you could say that abstract objects are a product of human intellection, like abstraction. Can you see? Like an activity of tajreed. You're doing something from the particulars that you sense. But it's in your mind. Your mind is doing it. The aql is doing it. So it's an operation of the mind. And so that abstraction that you made is a concept in your aql. So it resides here in your dhihn, yeah? Or you could say, you can take the other view and just say, look, abstract objects are just psychological facts. They're just facts about how your brain operates or something like that. It's a result of the way the cognitive processes are occurring in your mind. That makes it psychological matter in nature, not a metaphysical matter. And that's called psychologism. Then you've got the fourth position that just says, bah, these things don't exist. This talk about abstract objects, they don't exist in any concrete sense at all. They're abstract. And this is the nominalist view or the anti-realist view. There are no such things that are abstract. And then I'm going to go through some different views about anti-realist views, like what views Muslims could adopt. So if a Muslim wants
to be... the last one would be nominalism, right?
Yeah, you could put it under the nominalism. Yeah.
Okay. Because, you know, because I'm just thinking, you know, would the anti-realist deny conceptualism? I mean...
Well, it could if they want to accept it. That they could say, you know, that's a kind of psychologism and conceptualism.
Because the conceptualist is still not, you know, still not affirming that it truly exists extramentally.
But then you'd have to say that there are things of the mind that exist, right? You know, there are real entities of the mind that exist, you know, in some real ontological sense, right? And this is the idea of wujud dhihni, right? This idea of mental existence that comes from Ibn Sina. Uh-huh. So you could commit to that, right? You could just say there's an extra mental realm and there's a mental realm. Uh-huh. And they're both real. They're just two modes of existence. One exists, has wujud in this way, and one has wujud in this way. One has a concrete wujud in the extra mental world, fil kharij, and one has existence fil dhihn. But many people might say the conceptualist psychologism are sort of naturalist views. Hmm. They can be put within naturalism, right? And so there's no objectivity and necessity per se. There's no metaphysical objectivity or per se, because they will be contingent on the mind, the person thinking, psychological factors and things like that. So they won't be universal then in that sense. So, yeah, so I think a Muslim, if they're going down, if they're going to be looking at this abstract object and God discussion, here are the four options for them. If you're going to say it's connected to Allah in some way, either you're going to say they're external to Allah, internal, or created by Allah Azza wa Jal. Or if you take it away from the realm of the divine or the divine nature itself and then go into reality, coming down, descending, then you're going into reality. You just say these are things that we see. Redness is just whenever we come across an object that is red, we just see it instantiated with that object. That is what we see. We don't see some, we don't infer some universal attribute of redness, right? Or you could say, I don't want to take that view. I want to move these objects into the mind, our minds. Or you can say, no, I don't like that view. I've got no reason to believe them at all. I've got no reason to believe them at all. And they each have got their motivations. So just to spell it out again, Muslim realist views, if you're a Muslim realist or Platonist, if you believe that abstract objects are real and they're abstract and they're created, then you would believe in absolute creationism. If abstract objects are real and they're abstract, but they're uncreated, that's Platonism, right? If you believe that abstract objects are real, but they're concrete and physical, that's called formalism. This is, I think, what you were mentioning, Bassam, before. If you believe in abstract objects are real and they're concrete and they're mental, that's conceptualism. If you believe in abstract objects are real, concrete, and in the divine knowledge, then divine conceptualism. Now, if you're a Muslim anti-realist, you're a nominalist, what views could be open to you? Well, if you believe that abstract objects are not real, because that's what an anti-realist believes, they're not real, then any abstract object talk, anything you're discoursing about when it comes to abstract objects, you can either say, look, they're not literally true. I'm just positing these as fictional entities. So when I talk about these things, they don't really exist. So, you know, you could be a fictionalist, right? You could be a fictionalist and say these things they're not real. They're like characters in a story. I'm not, when I'm talking about them, I don't want to commit to them really existing. I'm just using them because they're within my language and things like that. Or you could say, very much like fictionalism, you can say, when I'm talking about abstract objects, I'm just indulging in make-believe. I'm using a kind of pretense when I'm talking about these things. I'm not really committed to them, but I'm using them in a way which gives, you know, gives the impression that they're real, but they're really not. And you and I both know that when we're speaking about these objects. Then there's another view, which is quite interesting. And it's that if maybe abstract objects are just a human production, a bit like how we produce a poem. We produce it, right? We produce it, but we don't say there's some abstract form of a poem, right? We just produced it from our mind. So let's take the Qasida Burda, for example. When Imam al-Busiri composed it, this on artifactualism, he composed it as a mere product of his imagination or mental activity. That's it. He brought it into the world. There wasn't an archetypal form of the Burda, which, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's artifactualism. Then you've got, you know, something which I think you saw also seen some early Kalam discussions where, and medieval sort of logicians, is suppositional theory. Let's just merely posit an object for the sake of discussion. Let's merely posit it. Let's suppose, but we're not committed to it ontologically. And finally, you could be an anti-realist and say, look, yeah, abstract objects aren't real, but they exist in the mind in some way. And you're a conceptualist, but you don't want to give it some kind of heavyweight existence in the mind. It's just there in the mind. That's some anti-Muslim anti-realist views that some can adopt. Just to skip on to contemporary issue, and then I'll close. Now, this discussion that we've been having, right, about abstract objects, you might think, well, what's this got to do with Islamic theology? What's this got to do with, our readers might think, or viewers might think, why, what's so relevant about this? Well, recently, as you may or may not be aware, you know, the discussion of this metaphysical idea called the Nafs al-Amr has come about again. And, you know, the Nafs al-Amr is a concept that was posited, or an idea that was posited to explain how we can objectively ground the truths of our propositions, our statements that we make. How do we objectively ground them? And then if you go back, remember I talked about the six motivations for Platonism. One of them was truth and objectivity. Well, how do we ground a proposition to be true in an objective way? You then had this concept of the nefs al-amr. And we could say a proposition P is true if and only if it corresponds to the nefs al-amr. So what then, the question then becomes is, the debate, the discussion, heavy discussion in pre-modern times, in post-classical times was, what then is the nafs al-amr? What is its nature? Can you see? And I want to come to that in just a bit. So a proposition will be true if it corresponds correctly to what is in nafs al-amr. So truth is determined by the correspondence of propositions to the objective reality or whatever the reality of the nafs al-amr is. So there must be some correspondence between what we're saying, our proposition, and this nafs al-amr. Because it's the nafs al-amr that makes the proposition true. So it's like a truth maker. It's like a truth maker. So what then is the nafs al-amr? Let's look at it. Some people say the nafs al-amr is the ilm of Allah Azza wa Jal. It's Allah's knowledge. So whatever corresponds to whatever is in Allah's knowledge is true. Some people put al-aql al-fa'al, you know, the agent intellect. Yeah, from the philosopher, right? Obviously going back to Neoplatonic times.
Is this like the Ismaili concept of the universal intellect or not?
Totally is a bit, but it's not, but remember, it's not just the Ismaili idea. The Ismailis took it from, you know, it's a Neoplatonic idea, right? Yeah, it's a Neoplatonic idea, which, you know, goes back to their sort of emanationist cosmology. You know, things, you know, unfolding or emanating, effusing out of the divine. So the active intellect sort of makes potential knowledge into actual knowledge in the same way that, you know, light makes potential colors into actual colors. This sort of the thing that acts on something to bring it about and so on. So anyway, so some people say if whatever a proposition is true, if it corresponds to what is in the active intellect, and al-aql al-fa'al, the active intellect or the productive intellect, the agent intellect, however it's translated into English from the Arabic. Then you got some like the Akbari school that say the nafs al-amr are the sort of unchanging, immutable archetypes, a'yan thabita. Some say it's al-lawh al-mahfuz. Some say, look, the nafs al-amr is just whatever is in the realm or the mental.
Sorry to take you back to number three. But, you know, these archetypes, will they still ground it within Allah's essence in some way? Or
no, his knowledge.
In his knowledge.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Right.
So a lot of these can overlap.
Yes, they do. They do. Yeah. But I wanted to subdivide them. You're right. Some of them can be lumped under broadly in philosophy, divine cognition. But we don't...
No. I mean, it's useful to look at it this way as well. I mean, because someone could affirm one without affirming three. But it seems like... you know, affirming three, especially if it's a Muslim who's trying to solve the Asay problem, would probably have to affirm one, at least, or something else.
Yeah. Okay. But the Ayan Thabita are the Sur. They are the forms or they are the images of the divine names, actually. They're the kind of representation of the divine Asma, the name. This is a very Akbarian, obviously, idea. So... how someone is going to understand Ayan Thabita, that is going to depend on, you know, what...
But the point is that they're still not locating it external, right?
Not as far, no. It's going to be...
Because I presume the Akbarians are still trying to resolve the Asay issue.
Yeah. It's going to be internal to Allah, right?
Yeah.
If we can use that term in that sense.
Yeah, but I guess they're just trying to, you know, articulate further how this mechanism is working somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So everything that will potentially exist and will exist in reality, already there is the essence and character of that thing that is yet to become, is already in the divine knowledge. They don't yet have existence. Can you see? Does that make sense? They have a potential subsistence in the divine knowledge. But they have no existence.
And they would affirm Allah's knowledge is unchanging, therefore
making absolutely.
And that's where they would ground the unchangingness, the immutability
Yes.
Okay.
Now, the nafs al-amr, some say, is just whatever is that exists. And what exists are things in the mental and extra-mental domain. That is what nafs al-amr is. Whatever's in here and out there beyond the mind. Some people say, no, actually, you know what? The nafs al-amr is just a term that is anaphoric, meaning it's whatever the context demands a discussion to be. Whatever you take your ontology, the parameters of your ontology to be, that is what nafs al-amr is. So if you have a physicalist ontology, then the nafs al-amr for you will be that entire ontology, because that is objective reality for you. If you are an idealist, that everything is rooted in the mind or thoughts, then the nafs al-amr for you will be that parameter. And so it's contextual, depends on what you mean by nafs al-amr, and then whether your proposition is congruent or corresponds with that nafs al-amr as you've defined it. So these are the different ideas of the nafs al-amr. And the reason why I say this is a contemporary issue of the Platonism, non-Platonism, or realism, anti-realism discussion is that those who espouse the nafs al-amr in an inflated sense, in a metaphysically inflated sense, say, you know, argue that there are such things as really existing abstract entities, call them universals, call them whatever you want to call them, right? But they really exist. It's just they're located ultimately in the divine knowledge. But they're real, right? They're real. Whereas those who say, no, there are no such objects like these, there are no such objects like these, they have a deflationary view, then they are non-Platonists, right? They are anti-realists when it comes to these entities. There are no such entities like A'yan Thabita. Yeah? Okay. So that is a sort of contemporary discussion. And it's raging, and it requires a session in and of itself, which is not the place here. But I wanted to put that out there. Because obviously this has a connection with what we've been talking about, and it's spilled into contemporary Islamic philosophical theology. Now, what are some concluding thoughts about this? Well, just to summarize, some Muslims believe in, you know, a realist Platonist view, right? Perspective. Some Muslims hold to an anti-realist nominalist perspective. However, on balance, Allah knows best. Yeah, on balance, it may be, that the anti-realist position on abstract objects is more intuitive, more metaphysically economical, and theologically less problematic. It may involve, so this anti-realist position may be one that involves the least philosophical speculation about the unseen matters. Because if you are going into the Platonic realm and you're linking that with the divine, you've got a lot of heavy lifting to do when it comes to speculating about the divine nature and so on. And matters of the mughayyabat. It may be that the anti-realist view requires lesser commitment to metaphysically tangled or complicated doctrines. It might be this anti-realist sort of nominalist position may seem more in keeping with our intuitions about how we talk about things existing. Do we really want to read off metaphysics, off language? Do we? When we're speaking, when I'm talking to you about days and months and weeks, am I really committing to days existing, months existing, weeks existing as abstract entities? You know, do we really want to read metaphysics off language like that? Is that what we're doing? And finally, it may seem that the anti-realist view is scripturally less complicated. Now, I'm not saying all these are definitive, you know, tarjih. Yeah. I'm just saying that these are considerations I think, you know, may merit the nominalist position for the believer to adopt the anti-realist position. But Allah knows best. Allah knows best. So I'll end it there.
Barakallahu feekum akhifaf for that, you know, very informative presentation. I just want to say that, you know, I'm genuinely appreciative and thankful for your efforts in fulfilling the fard kifaya of addressing many of these niche philosophical arguments. You know, many of my apologist friends aren't motivated to embark on spending hundreds of hours of research time sifting through the literature to address arguments that might only affect a very small niche segment of the ummah. But, you know, the fact remains that we are still obligated to address these shubuhat, even if they only intellectually impact one Muslim, right? And I want to acknowledge that you're doing this. And, you know, this is the fourth time I'm interviewing you where you're addressing these niche arguments. And Unfortunately, it's a very thankless job, but I want to publicly thank you and appreciate you for your efforts. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala put this on your scales of good deeds. I mean, and maybe one question before I let you go. I do appreciate how you've provided different options for our listeners who may come from different theological backgrounds, giving them, you know, pretty much letting them know that regardless of your background, you know, there is hope in resolving this specific objection, right? But maybe for our listeners who are maybe not advanced طلاب العلم, they could be Athari listeners, Ash'ari listeners, Maturidi listeners.
Yeah.
Not, they might be thinking to themselves right now, but what should I believe? What should I incline to given the theological school I ascribe to? So I was wondering if maybe you could spend a minute or two basically saying something like along the lines of, look, if you are a muqallid of the Ash'ari school, you would probably want to adopt this. If you're a following Ibn Taymiyyah, you probably want to follow this. Just maybe to kind of guide and direct our listeners who are, you know, not all of them may be advanced students of knowledge. They may be doing taqlid of their theological school and may want to continue doing so on this given topic. So maybe just a little direction, if you may.
Provide. Yeah, I mean, that's so important. JazakAllah khair, Habibi. That's so important. It really is. Yeah, I think these discussions, first and foremost, I would say, honestly, I know we are, I'm presenting a sketch of it here, and it's really taken out a lot of things. Some of the details can be can be read in the handout, but I want to give just an overview of the topic. If first, I always say this, first and foremost, if someone just feels, I don't really want to go into this, they should not feel obligated to go into the topic at all.
Yeah.
Wallah, and I say this in all seriousness and directness, there really isn't any, there's no pressing need for anyone necessarily. But having said that, for those of you know, who perhaps feel attracted or are finding they're being, you know, taken up in this discussion, because it is playing out, you know, as I hear on social media and things like that, and in written form, you will find in the classical kalam, so like sort of up until Imam al-Ghazali's time, generally the mutakallimun, on the whole, again, I'm saying this in broad strokes, and you know, I don't want to be crucified, but, you know, but I'm just saying broad strokes, you will find that they were anti-realist in that sense. They were not, they didn't have an inflationary metaphysics in the sense that we have later on, like after Imam Fakhruddin al-Razi, rahimahullah, and in certain traditions, like philosophical akbari, like philosophical Sufism and things like that. So those who are perhaps committed to those kalam schools, the Ash'ari, Maturidi, and feel that is where their strength and commitment is, by all means, you know, that adhere to that view. What I'm not saying, what I don't want to say to those who are sort of realist in the sense or Platonist in the sense, is that divine conceptualism is an absolutely wacky idea. I'm not saying that at all. In fact, that's a valid locating something in the ilm of Allah Azza wa Jal, you know, is a possible view.
Yeah. It resolves the like, assay problem.
Sorry?
It resolves the assay problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It does. And so that might be a matter worth exploring for those of our brothers and sisters, perhaps who are new to it or being introduced to the topic, check out divine conceptualism. Otherwise, you know, the sort of non-committal idea, the anti-realist, the nominalist view, which is a view I personally, I'm not saying I'm merely personally holding to it, gives it weight. This is my personal view. I'm not committed to abstract objects existing, having an ontology, but I can see the strength and the merits in a divine conceptualist view. I even see a merit in the conceptualist view, the human conceptualist view. What I want people to understand is that perhaps from our tradition, there are quite a number of views one can adopt. But what I would say is not to make it another battleground.
Yeah. We don't need that.
But yeah, subhanAllah, this is something we shouldn't be doing. Although perhaps some people think it's a matter of raising the sword and the shield, and then they've got to go out there and convince everyone about it. Though I see why some have taken that stance. But I think it's very important that don't be sectarian about it. And And so be very understanding and compassionate towards one another on these issues. That's not to say, and I've got to make this clear, I'm not saying that there aren't heretical views, Akhi. I believe that there are. I believe like some of, you know, these views within the Platonism, Neo-Platonism sphere, for me, I think it'd be quite very troublesome theologically. But we shouldn't make it sectarian. And anyone coming to the topic will see how rich our tradition is when it comes to these sort of views. So, yeah, I guess it depends on what period of the tradition someone is more familiar with and comfortable with. Stick with that tradition, that period of time. If it's early, early. If it's later, it's later. But as with everything, try and do your reading, try and do your research, try and discuss before one starts to pick a sword and a shield and then go out there and think it's a battlefield. And in all honesty, you know, and it's a reminder to myself first, before a reminder to anyone else, often people do get into these discussions and they've not done the difficult work of doing the reading. And that's important. That's important. So, yeah, those in a roundabout way, see what your tradition, ask the scholars of your tradition who you follow, what the matter is when it comes to this issue, and then, you know, and take it up further from there. But I think it's an exciting area. It's a very exciting area. There's lots to be done. And I hope that us introducing it now is in some way helpful to see that there are answers, by the way, whether from the conceptualist, divine conceptualist, absolute creationism, whatever view you want to label these, you can take the labels away. My point is, as long as you understand where you're placing the abstract object and knowing what the entailments are of each, you're going to fall into one of these four generally anyway. Mm. You're going to find if you believe that the real abstract objects, you're going to locate them somewhere, either somewhere with Allah, in reality, within human beings, i.e. minds, or they don't exist at all. And so I personally think believing that they're external to Allah, other than that view, i.e. heavyweight Platonism, I think the others are open to anyone exploring. I think heavyweight Platonism is a problem. I don't want to believe in anything independent of Allah Azza wa Jal. I think that's theologically problematic. Allah knows best. Honestly. But the other worth looking at, I am looking at the anti-realist views. That's where my inclinations are. Others might find the inclinations. And I think you intimated as well that you're somewhere around the sort of what? The anti-realist area?
Yeah, I mean, you know, between conceptualism and anti-realism.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Yeah, human conceptualism. Right. There you go. So this is what I say. It's and that has a rich theological, rich intellectual set of arguments behind it. And before anyone starts to say, oh, conceptualism makes it, go look at the arguments, you know. So alhamdulillah, you know, this topic is exciting. It's important. Hopefully it will address some problems some people may have, some doubts, some shubuhat. But as we will see, that when we look at some of the arguments, maybe in a bit of detail in another session maybe, or if someone reads a handout, they'll be able to appreciate the merits of each view.
Yeah, you know, what I really appreciate about your presentation is that, you know, you didn't narrow down the solution to just one single solution, right? Like, as you said, I mean, it's free reign, you know, keeping aside heavyweight Platonism. It's up to other people to explore and weigh the arguments for the alternatives. The main thing is don't violate a fixed theological principle, such as Allah's independence, Allah's Allah's sovereignty. That don't violate these fixed principles, and, you know, look to your respective traditions, see what your scholars have preferred, or if you're doing taqlid, if you're, you know, want to research this further, explore these different options. And it's good. I'm always happy when I see that a theological problem could be resolved in more than one way, right? I don't like to narrow people down to one single solution every time. So I think, so barakallahu feek, you know, once again, Akhisaf, for your efforts here. And I think we could end it on this note. Is there anything else that you'd like to...
JazakAllahu khairan. Thank you. That's a really positive note to end on, you know, and this unity is so important. But you know, understand that these are metaphysical issues, right? You know, they can be approached in different ways. Jazakallah
Well,
khairan.
barakallahu fik, akhi Safa. We hope to have you on again for the fifth time. I'm just eager to wait and see what new niche argument you're going to be addressing next time, and we'll get you on, inshallah ta'ala.
Inshallah.
With that said, part you and our listeners with the greetings of Assalamu alaikum, rahmatullahi.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.